Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zamer. It's my privilege to serve as the minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming you this morning by one of our newest worship associates, Jeff Marsh, our director of religious education, Karen Lapidus, our music director, Hal Walker, and both the Golden Tones Junior Choir and the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent Tone Chimers this morning. We have wonderful music in store for us today. We also have a special announcement this morning from one of the co-chairs of our stewardship campaign, which we've been conducting all month long. And we are very happy this morning to hear from Meg Milko.
Thank you very much. We are, as Melissa said, putting a close on our annual stewardship campaign called Raising the Bar. We hope you liked the little bit of change-up we did this year. We thought we'd move away from the pies for a moment and give you some other nice, sweet bar treats. But as we're coming to a close, all of us on the committee want to thank a big thank you to the canvassers. We could not do this without them. Our goal is to reach out to everybody at this time of year and check in with you and see if you can also pledge and contribute your monetary gifts to the church. So we appreciate and thank all of them for the good job that they did. Also, I want to thank all of you who have already pledged. We couldn't do this without the support and commitment from all of us. And so if you have not yet made your pledge, there's still time. So see us downstairs. We're going to have our table set up. Also, we wanted to let you know that while the campaign is off to a robust start and we're doing really well, we're still short of our goal. So if you have pledged and can review your situation and possibly do the increase that we were asking, that would go a long way in helping us reach our goal so we can provide some of the extra things that we want to provide this coming fiscal year. Also, our main goal to get up here and talk with you is to come and help us celebrate. We want to celebrate the close, and this morning we're offering you frozen fruit treats downstairs. We've got some nice, juicy fruit bars that we'd like you to participate and celebrate with us. So if you can all come down during coffee hour, that would be great. We'd love to see you down there. And thank you all very much.
Work has gone into conducting this stewardship campaign, so will you please join me? Actually, let me ask you first, if you were one of the co-chairs, would you please stand and be recognized? Claudia Miller and Meg Milko and Kathy Slater. And then all the canvassers as well, which are many. We had over 20 canvassers. So if you were a canvasser this year, will you please be recognized? Thank you all for helping tend the life and health of our beloved community.
We light the chalice this morning with the words of Howard Thurman, the African-American Baptist pastor, theologian, and civil rights leader. The moving finger of God in human history points ever in the same direction. There must be community.
There was a time, I believe, life was over for me. There was a time, I believe, my life was over. I feel strong today, thanks to your help, I'll find my way. I too will lend you a hand when you need one. Sometimes I get so down, I feel like this is the end, like there's no way at all I can.
Our call to worship today comes from Harry Emerson Fosdick. We ask the leaf, "Are you complete in yourself?" And the leaf answers, "No, my life is in the branches." We ask the branch, and the branch answers, "No, my life is in the root." We ask the root, and it answers, "No, my life is in the trunk, and the branches, and the leaves. Keep the branches stripped of leaves, and I shall die." So it is with the great tree of being. Nothing is completely and merely individual.
You may have noticed that I like history, and during the Time for All Ages, I often make historical references and celebrate and lift up the lives of our Unitarian Universalist ancestors. But today I'm drawing my remarks from a story that recently went viral on the internet. Today's story is about Desiree Andrews, a young teen living in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Desiree is a cheerleader for the boys' basketball team at her middle school. Desiree has Down syndrome. She was inspired to become a cheerleader because of a character on the television show Glee. She told herself and her parents that if that character with Down syndrome could be a cheerleader, so could she. And so she did. At a basketball game last school year, some students from the opposing team's school started taunting Desiree from the stands, teasing and bullying her because of her disability. A player from the home team called for a timeout. Chase Vasquez, Miles Rodriguez, and Scooter Tarian walked off the court to confront the bullies. One of the players stepped up and said, "Don't with her." Afterward, they explained why they felt compelled to act in defense of their classmate and now their friend. "We walked off the court and went to the bullies and told them to stop because it's not right to be mean to another person," said Miles. And in a tradition that began last year, the introduction of the starting lineup for the boys' basketball team always includes Desiree. As the starting players are introduced, they give fist bumps and high fives to Desiree as they run onto the court. And the gym has been renamed Dee's House in her honor. And the students wear T-shirts celebrating her inclusion with the team. The middle school basketball coach recently told the local news that the players have really stepped up, almost like they are big brothers to her. And just last week, the basketball players received recognition from the city of Kenosha for defending Desiree from bullies. Desiree's community of peers stepped up to support her. Recognizing the pain of being a victim of bullying, they became her circle of kinship, extending their kindnesses to help her heal. The actions of her community of fellow students declare, "Not only are we going to protect you from bullies, but we honor you for what you accomplish despite your disability."
To lead us into a time of silence, meditation, and prayer, a poetic rendering of the 23rd Psalm. This is among the most beloved of Psalms and has inspired many poetic renderings over the years. This one comes from a collection of Psalms cast in this way by Nancy Merrill. "Oh, my beloved, you are my shepherd, I shall not want. You bring me to green pastures and lead me beside still waters, renewing my spirit. You restore my soul. You lead me in the path of goodness to follow love's way. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow and of death, I am not afraid, for you are ever with me. Your rod and your staff, they guide me. They give me strength and comfort. You prepare a table before me in the presence of all my fears. You bless me with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the heart of the beloved forever." And I invite you to join with me now in the spirit of prayer. Oh, beloved, in this moment of rest, Help us open our hearts to you. Help us open our hearts so that we may remember what matters most, to set aside the worries and distractions and constant demands upon our lives and remember what truly matters here in this moment of renewal. We gather here this day for rest and for remembering and for honoring the gift of this life. In recognizing the gift, may we be mindful of all of our blessings, for it is gratitude that is the foundation of hope, and hope is essential to carry us through our lives in this world. From gratitude to hope, from hope to possibility, from possibility to action. Let these be the movements of our lives. Amen, and blessed be.
Well, we made it. The winter of 2015 is officially over. There will be no more sub-zero days. Any snow we should get should not last on the ground that long. The daffodils are coming up. There should be no more snow days with the kids home from school. I think back to what helped us make it through the dark winter months. And I recall the hope of spring. Garden plans, baseball games, long walks without winter boots on, sitting outside for supper, and maybe, just maybe, opening up the windows. How did we make it through this winter anyway? Of course, there were the holidays with the colorful lights, food and gatherings with family and friends, getting together to see basketball games or concerts. You might have even cuddled up on the couch to binge watch the latest Netflix show with someone you love. Somehow we made it through those very cold, dark nights together. This brought me to think about the question I am most often asked about my job. As some of you know, I am a hospice doctor. The reaction I usually get is, oh, that must be really depressing. Well, actually, it isn't. Sure, I spend my days seeing patients suffering with pain, shortness of breath, or progressive debility, surrounded by families entering into the grieving process. It actually sounds pretty bad. But actually, the experience is very uplifting. In the depths of illness, I see moments of the most honest affection, compassion, and courage. I see families that have been separated by great distances come together to share memories of their times together. I see others that have been close in miles but estranged find a way to be together in the same room. I see patients pick out things that are the most important in their lives and families and friends that make it happen. Like Lefty, whose heart was failing and had decided he'd had enough dialysis. He most wanted one last game of bridge with the friends that he'd been sharing that game every Friday for years. We wheeled him up to the table and he dealt his cards. Robert had metastatic lung cancer, but he wanted to ride his lawn tractor one last time. His family brought it to our compassionate care center and we helped him up on the seat so he could gun the engine and smile. Each was only a few days before their death. The reason sadness does not take over is because of the team that pulls together to provide care to these patients, families, and to one another. We meet weekly to share our experiences and our concerns. We share a moment of reflection and a prayer. We joke and we occasionally cry, but we do it together. The motto at our hospice is, "We are friends for the journey." This applies to the patients and also applies to each of us. Hopefully, all of us have friends to make our journey to a time of warmth and light a little more bearable.
We laugh, we cry, we live, we die, we dance, we sing our song. Resilience is one of those things that helps us keep singing our song through all the seasons of our life. And we've been exploring resilience this month, especially the resilience of the collective, of the family, of the organization, of the community. And the stories that were told this morning by Karen and by Jeff, I think, point to some of the ways in which communities can help foster resilience. It makes a difference when we have people who come together with us and share their lives with us and are present, fully present. It makes a difference when our communities can not only tolerate, but also welcome and celebrate diversity in their midst. It makes a difference when people feel that they can speak their hearts and minds and that others will listen. It makes a difference when communities have structures in place to support people through the inevitable hard times we all face. And it makes a difference to know that we're not alone. These differences form the foundation for resilient communities that in turn help create resilient families, resilient people. So I have another story for you. This one is about a community in Washington, D.C., and it was founded by a man named Donald Robinson. This man had a vision. He wanted to create a Unitarian Universalist community ministry in one of the marginalized communities of Washington, D.C. And so, though the Unitarian Universalist Association at that time was not ordaining community ministries and there wasn't a model for what he wanted to do, he went to theological school with this clear vision. And he completed a congregational internship with this clear vision. And in 1991, he graduated and was ordained as the first Unitarian Universalist community minister in a long, long time. And he immediately set about making his vision into a reality. So the first thing he did was partner with the Residence Council at Edgewood Terrace Community, which was a poor, drug-infested, gang-ridden, beleaguered community in Washington, D.C. And they had this residence council that he had relationship with, and so he invited them into partnership, and they accepted. So they were his first partners. And his second partners were the members of the congregation where he had completed his congregational internship, the Unitarian Universalist Church of Rockville, Maryland. And so together, They created this community ministry. They dreamed it into being. And the members of the church got to know the members of the residence council. And they started with a Saturday program for kids. And the members of the church came over to volunteer to be a part of working with the kids. And they donated money. And the little fledgling ministry that they started inspired others who are part of Unitarian Universalist congregations in the D.C. area. And Reverend Donald Robinson started going out and speaking as a guest to those congregations. And one by one, they joined on as partners too. And so within a couple of years' time, 15 of the Unitarian Universalist congregations in the D.C. area had become partners of this community ministry called Beacon House. And from those humble beginnings in 1991, Beacon House today was recently voted one of the very best small nonprofit organizations in the DC area, and they provide a complete range of services for the children of the Edgewood Terrace community. They have after-school program and before-school programs, a summer camp that goes all summer. Kids can come for all or part of the summer, tutoring programs throughout the school year, mentorship programs for the teens, college preparatory programs for the older teens, athletic programs, music and art programs, a meal program every day for the kids who participate in the services that they offer. And then during the day, when the kids are at school, the adults in the community are invited into the facility to use the computers for their own personal needs, job searches, to answer questions they may have, and to connect with the staff, which now numbers 9 full-time and a whole host of part-time staff working in this community ministry. It's an inspiring example. And it makes me think about what we might be able to do. This congregation does some wonderful things to nurture community resilience. We partner with Kent Social Services and have for a long time and regularly take collections to help support the food pantry. And some members of the congregation have volunteered there on and off throughout the years. And we have groups of people, most recently our own coming-of-age youth group, who work with Trinity Lutheran Church to prepare the Saturday hot meal program that congregation serves. And we have a group of people who go out to the Skills Community Center to tutor children. And these are all excellent examples of ways that we, with our gifts of abundance, can help nurture community resilience. And I wonder what more we could do if we reached out and developed partnerships with others in the community or with other Unitarian Universalist congregations in our area. You might call these kinds of ministries that I'm talking about that invest in community resilience a kind of community service, and that's one way of describing them, but there's more to it than simply service. Because when we reach out in these ways, we're also putting ourselves in a position to learn and grow. So it's not a one-sided relationship. It's not a, I have extra, and so I'm going to come share with you, and it's all about me giving to you. There's a mutuality, a learning and a serving, and a growing together. And with these resources to invest in building the resilience of community, we build our own resilience too. Everybody involved in the relationship gets something of value. Theologically speaking, ministries that nurture community resilience are a natural fit for us. We espouse an ethic of interdependence, and we affirm that it isn't enough to just be for ourselves. Instead, we endeavor to be mindful of all of the ties that bind us together. People who come before us in this tradition used to say that it isn't enough to focus on our own salvation. We don't use that word so much anymore, but I think the principle still applies. It's not enough to just be concerned that we get what we want and what we need for ourselves and for our families, because we're in this together and we share the same fate. And though there is little we can control, we do have great power to influence our collective experiences and the experiences of those who will come when we are gone. Our calling is to help create just, peaceful and compassionate communities in which all people have the opportunity not only to survive, but also to realize their full potential. And these are the values that make us Unitarian Universalist. Part of what makes this faith tradition my home is the fact that when we're speaking and thinking in this way, we don't draw the circle just around the human community. The circle is drawn wider to include all of our communities. We include the life and the elements that make up all of the communities of the earth. Our ethic of interdependence includes the soils and the waters, the air, and all the creatures of the land and the sky and the sea. All of it is part of our circle of interdependence, and so therefore should be part of the circle of resilience that we can help build. Their fate is bound up with ours, and our fate is bound up with theirs. This past week, I attended a conference in New Orleans, which was focused on exploring some of these things. The conference was hosted by an organization that I've been serving on the steering committee of for the last 6 years called Unitarian Universalist Allies for Racial Equity. And we held the conference in partnership with our partnering organization, which goes by the acronym DRUM, standing for Diverse Revolutionary Unitarian Universalist Multicultural Ministries. And because that's a mouthful, everybody just says DRUM. And so DRUM is a people of color organization in Unitarian Universalism, and Allies for Racial Equity is an organization of people who identify as white, and we work together on issues of racism in not only the association, but also in our larger world. And this year, we decided to focus our conference on the intersections of racism and the environmental justice movement. And so the conference was called Healing the Waters, Healing Ourselves. And we all gathered in New Orleans, hosted by an organization called the Center for Ethical Living and Social Justice Renewal. This organization is housed in the First Unitarian Church of New Orleans, which is a downtown congregation. And it was started by the three Greater New Orleans Unitarian Universalist congregations after Hurricane Katrina to help build the city again, to contribute to the resilience of the community of New Orleans. And this organization has a commitment to partner with other community organizations in the Greater New Orleans area. And they do amazing work, the Center for Ethical Living and Social Justice Renewal. They bring groups from across the country, from all kinds of organizations to New Orleans to engage in service learning work. And so we arrived sandwiched between two college groups that were there for alternative spring break. And all throughout the year they have groups coming in to work in the community. And so they have a great web of partnership. And they ask every group that works at their center, whether it be for a weekend like our conference or to coming for a week like the college alternative spring break, to do some service learning in the community. And so we readily agreed to that, our conference planners did, and we asked the participants to go with us to one of the partners of the center for some service learning as the very first thing that we did at the conference. And the group that we worked with is called Green Light New Orleans. And I want to tell you about this organization today because I think the work they're doing has a lot to teach us. Green Light New Orleans was started by a man named Andreas Hoffman, who is originally from Switzerland. And he emigrated to this country as a young adult and has lived here ever since in New Orleans. Like everybody else in New Orleans, he had to evacuate after the hurricane and was gone for several months. And when he came back to his home in New Orleans, he thought to himself, surely there is an element of climate change that affected this storm. Like all, you know, the rise in droughts and severe weather all across the world, he thought, surely there's an element of climate change here. And I have been meaning to make a little change to my life to help mitigate the impact of climate change, and I'm going to do it right now. That was his commitment when he came back. And so he decided he was going to change all the light bulbs in his house, which were still incandescent, to CFL bulbs. And so he went out and bought all the bulbs he would need to change every single light bulb in his house. And he felt a small measure of satisfaction for having taken this concrete action. And then, over the months to come, he started noticing that his electric bill was pretty significantly reduced from changing all those light bulbs at once. And that got him to start thinking about what other kinds of savings had been generated by this change. And so he started researching the ways in which he had contributed to that his effort had reduced the amount of impact upon the environment by changing these light bulbs. And he was astounded by what he found. And it got him thinking, what if everybody in New Orleans did what I did and changed every single light bulb in their house? And he immediately realized that that would not be feasible for many people. The cost would be prohibitive, several hundred dollars to change every single light bulb. And he thought, well, maybe there's a way around that. So he started looking for others who were motivated by this vision of getting people to change all the light bulbs in their house. And he realized that he could partner with the government, because the government in many places of the country will distribute those bulbs for free. And so he partnered with the government, and he partnered with other community organizations, and he found individuals who shared his vision, and they created this organization, Green Light New Orleans. And for the last 9 years, they have been providing a free service to any member of the New Orleans community that they will send volunteers out to change every single light bulb in their house. And part of what makes this different from other light bulb distribution programs in other parts of the country is because they send volunteers to actually do the work, there is an assurance that the light bulbs actually get changed rather than just sitting in a closet or being sold again by people who are really struggling to make ends meet. The volunteers go in, as my group did. There were five of us, and they usually send people in groups of 3 to 5, and they go into people's houses by appointment. These people have signed up to have their light bulbs changed. And so we knocked on the door, and we went in with a trunk full of these CFL light bulbs, and it took us about an hour, five people, and we changed every single light bulb in the house. We took the incandescent bulbs with us when we went, and all the people who participate in this program sign a pledge that they will recycle the CFL bulbs when they burn out in 3 to 5 years. And the volunteers are given fact sheets to help people see what kind of savings they can realize, both financial and environmental, from this change. So it's a little tiny thing, but it has had an enormous impact over the 9 years that they've been doing this. In the last couple of years, they have added new pieces to their vision, this organization, Green Light New Orleans. And so one of the things that they offer in addition to the light bulb program is a 4x6 raised bed backyard garden. So anybody who has a backyard in which they are permitted, whether they own the house or not, to have a garden, they can request for volunteers to come out and install one and plant it for free. And so one of our groups actually went out and did that. And in the course of an afternoon, five volunteers built a raised bed garden, filled it with soil, planted it with seedlings that Green Light New Orleans raises, taught the family how to recognize what it is that they were growing and recognize when it should be harvested and eaten. And those families sign a pledge that they will welcome another group of volunteers back in 3 to 6 months to help them learn what to do next after they have harvested everything in their garden so that they can develop the skills to continue this for themselves. And this is also part of the environmental vision, helping reduce the impact of people needing to travel to get fresh food, helping reduce the impact of fresh food traveling to people, and also teaching people the skills that they need so that they can do this for a lifetime. And it's all free. So this is the second phase that's been implemented. And once that is as stable as the light bulb program, they plan to implement their third phase, which is water conservation. Now, New Orleans is one of the rainiest cities in the whole country, so a lot of people don't think about water conservation there. But this, most of the city is below sea level. And there are these pumping stations all across the city. Whenever there's any significant rainfall, the pumping stations have to pump out the water or they're going to constantly have flooding. And that takes a tremendous amount of energy. And so Green Light's vision is to begin installing wherever people can get permission to do so, whether if they own their houses or not, rain barrels on their houses to help capture the excess water that New Orleans is constantly struggling with. But it doesn't rain every day in New Orleans, and so there's still cause for people to turn on the hoses to water their yards and their gardens. And so Green Light's vision is if there were rain barrels installed in people's houses, it would reduce the impact of the pumping stations needing to pump water out of the city if this were done on a large scale, and it would reduce the use of water in the dry seasons. And so they're hoping in the next couple of years to be implementing that as well. And like everything else that they do, it will be free and provided by volunteers. One of the geniuses of the organization is that volunteers don't need to have an ongoing relationship. Groups like ours can show up, get oriented in half an hour, and then go out and spend 4 or 5 hours engaged in the service learning that they opportunities that they provide, and it makes a difference that that group goes and another group comes in. In fact, we saw that happening as we were packing up to go. There was another group coming in to do their work. So it's a really remarkable organization, and I think can give us inspiration about the ways in which we might imagine helping build resilient communities. All three of their interventions are fairly simple. The power comes from having them implemented on a large scale. And by making everything free, it's accessible to all the people of New Orleans, which helps everybody in that city reduce their impact on the environment, which ultimately contributes to the resilience of the community as a whole. And this story is just one example of so many that are happening all around the world of people who are finding ways to contribute to the resilience of their communities, most especially in fragile ecosystems like coastal communities, which are finding it difficult to deny the impacts of climate change because they're seeing it firsthand, seeing the destruction firsthand from severe weather, increased flooding, and increased storms. And so those people can help the rest of us who are maybe not quite in the midst of it just yet see the ways in which the future is unfolding and inspire the rest of us to help find ways to realize that our fate is bound up with the fate of the planet. Any actions that we can take to reduce our environmental impact are also an investment in our collective capacity for resilience and an investment in the resilience of the people who will come when we are gone. Theologically, this matters to us as Unitarian Universalists because our faith tradition understands interdependence broadly. We know that we humans are a very small part of the web of life and that we're responsible for the ways that we affect the web. Spiritually, this may matter to you personally if you find a connection to that which is larger than yourself in the natural world. If you find a connection to that which is larger than yourself in flowers or in forests or on seashores or in mountains or in any other natural place on this planet, this may matter to you spiritually. And this may matter to you spiritually if you find a connection to that which is larger than yourself with any of the creatures of the world, with dogs or with cats or dolphins or eagles or any other creature of the sky or the land or the sea. We are all connected and we rely upon the same source for sustenance. In her poetic interpretation of the 23rd Psalm, Nan Merrill calls that source beloved. You may call that source by other names, universe, or Gaia, or God. Whatever name you choose to name that source, the nature of the relationship is one of dependence and one of blessing. We're blessed with green pastures and still waters. We're blessed with sunrises and sunsets, no matter what we have done or failed to do in any given day. We're blessed with raspberries and blueberries and almonds, and truly with milk and honey. So many sources of sustenance, our cup indeed overflows. We're blessed with beauty and mystery and wonder, and we didn't create any of it ourselves. It was all given. We don't know why or how, but we know that we're dependent upon all of these gifts. And whenever we remember that dependence and remember that blessing, it opens the way to gratitude. And gratitude is truly the foundation of hope that can help us invest in our communities and in the communities of the future. May it be so, and amen. Will the ushers please come forward? Every month we take a special collection for an organization whose work we'd like to support, and our collection this morning is for the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. The UUSC has many projects, but this morning we're focused on World Water Day. One of their areas of concern is the right to water around the world, and this day is World Water Day. It's also being marked as Climate Justice Sunday by a whole host of environmental organizations. And Unitarian Universalist Service Committee is inviting your contribution of support for the good work that they do to help us be stewards of the earth. Any size contribution will provide you with a membership to the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, but you'll see in your order of service that donations of particular amounts will provide you with particular benefits. The blessing of truth be upon us, the power of love to direct and sustain us, and may the peace of this community preserve our going out and our coming in from this time forth until we meet again. Go in peace.